which comes with hardship, which comes with problems, which comes with, I don't know, things that are cause me a new discomfort. But that's natural. Let us take a short break and then we will come back right after.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So we're talking about hardship. So the Imam says, "Oh Allah, I seek refuge in you from causing myself hardships more than what you've already given me." Even though Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not cause people hardship, we cause ourselves hardship. So when we live our life, we have to make sure that we live it in such a way that we carry out on our responsibilities without having to create the extra that's not required. And when it comes to extra trouble, for example, you can say that I can live with an X amount of money and that should suffice me, suffice my family. But then you can see that there are times where I say no, I want to have more and I struggle to have more. And I put myself in so much effort and into so much problems just so I can do what? Gain more wealth. And obviously, this is not required. This is not needed. This is just going to cause me problems. So I have to be satisfied with the pain and the trouble of having to go through that actual thing just to sustain myself, not to go over and over and over. So we see that sometimes we, also in this regard, we put ourselves in this trouble that is not required. And also in terms of trying to provide for ourselves the best. Sometimes in order to have the best, I have to put myself in so much trouble just to get it. So sometimes I put myself in debt just so I can buy the latest phone. Sometimes I put myself in a credit card debt just so I could buy some clothes. Sometimes I put myself in a lifetime of debt just so I can do what? So I can buy a house. So we have to be very careful not to put ourselves in these kind of debts and these kind of troubles. We seek refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from the troubles that we cause ourselves and the hardships. Stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Esam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government, based in the capital Sana'a, has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension. Due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014, and we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Yusumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator.
The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions-hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade US invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Family members of the victims of the Itaewon tragedy and thousands of their supporters remembered those 158 mostly young people whose lives were taken in a crowd crush October 29th. Some read letters to their lost loved ones.
Last year, we made a whole bunch of snow ducks all around outside our apartment. Please come and see me in my dreams sometimes. Please come see me someday. Maybe even as my future child. I love you forever, Seon.
Although tens of thousands were gathered, police did not manage the crowds and ignored emergency calls hours before the deadly crush. Among those who perished in the tragedy, 26 of them were foreigners. Five of those were Iranian. And like many of the young people who died that evening, they were students who visited South Korea to get more experience in the world and primarily more education to better themselves. Victims' families want the truth and those responsible brought to justice. A class action lawsuit is suing the government, which has often deflected responsibility and blamed the victims. It reminds some of the ferry sinking in 2014, in which more than 300 people died.
The law should be a law to punish wrong people, but the government is humiliating, insulting, and degrading the victims and the families of the deceased. In the end, I think this happened because the Sewol ferry accident was not properly resolved.
Tonight marked the 49th day since the tragedy, signifying the end of the mourning period, when the spirit of those dead to be reborn reaches Buddha and bliss. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It's a daybreak. Raju Yadav is piling up his stock for the delivery in the retail market. He's delighted, saying markets are picking good pace and prices in the whole markets are not fluctuating since last quarter. Earlier, I would buy limited stock, he says. But since the prices are consistent and demand is satisfactory, I have bought more stock than usual. I'm testing my luck, he says. Many Indians like Raju are optimistic as the country is picking up pace as the fast-growing major economy.
We are not strictly a very heavily exporting nation. Most of our producers actually rely on our domestic market. But exports are important for us because we do import some very critical commodities.
Experts say with COVID outbreak shaking major economies, India maintained its consistency in almost all sectors except the manufacturing and employment, which they say is like a diesel engine and needs a major boost. Many economic experts say investments are flowing smoothly in the world's second most populous nation, adding the country needs to revitalize its manufacturing sector, job creation, and address bottlenecks in power, mining, and infrastructure.
More than the economy, I would say our problem, what the manufacturing sector can boost is good jobs, you know, which all Indians will agree are lacking in India. I mean, that's why so many of us go abroad, right? Because these good jobs are lacking, we are wasting our talent. And the reason is that we have never seriously thought about how to make manufacturing grow.
India growth forecast is projected at 7% despite turbulent markets and war in Ukraine that shook markets. Based on Morgan Stanley and S&P Global, the country is projected to overtake Japan and Germany to become the third largest economy by 2030. Economic experts say trade tensions between the United States and China will also open up new opportunities for India as the companies are considering India for production capacity as a second option. Many, however, argue India needs double-digit growth, which would be vital for the second most populous nation, where a huge workforce and young professionals join the market every year, besides lifting millions out of poverty. While the coronavirus pandemic ravaged the world's economy, India managed to mitigate the impact of the outbreak, mainly by relying on its domestic market. But experts say the economic growth is expected to fall in the coming months as the country grapples with high inflation, rising unemployment, and a spike in oil prices, and also a threat of global economic recession. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Protests through Brussels on Friday was organized by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol, and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to
raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
Experts say the United States remains the number one arms exporting nation on the planet. This country actually likes tension in the world because it feeds on the tension by stoking tension between countries and regions around the world and selling arms to the conflicting sides. The U.S. regime fills the pockets of military-industrial complex. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Truthout had an eye on this issue, writing, "Here's a seldom commented upon reality of this century and this moment. The United States remains the number one arms exporting nation on the planet. Between 2017 and 2021, it grabbed 39% of the total global weapons market, and there is nothing new about that. It has, in fact, been the top arms dealer in every year, but one for the past three decades. And it's a remarkably lucrative business, earning American weapons makers tens of billions of dollars annually. It would be one thing if it were simply a matter of money raked in by the industrial half of the military-industrial complex. Unfortunately, in these years, U.S.-supplied weaponry has also fueled conflicts, enabled human rights violations, helped destabilize not just individual countries but whole regions, and made it significantly easier for repressive regimes to commit war crimes." At first glance, it appeared that Joe Biden, on entering the White House, might take a different approach to arms sales. On the campaign trail in 2020, he had, for instance, labeled Saudi Arabia a pariah state and implied that the unbridled flow of U.S. weaponry to that kingdom would be reduced, if not terminated. He also bluntly assured voters that this country wouldn't check its values at the door to sell arms. Initially, Biden paused arms deals to that country and even suspended one bomb sale. Unfortunately, within 8 months of his taking office, sales to Saudi regime had resumed. In addition, the Biden team has offered arms to a number of other repressive countries, from Egypt to Nigeria and Philippines. Such sales contrast strikingly with the president's mantra of supporting democracies over autocracies, as well as his reasonable impulse to supply weapons to Ukraine. There are numerous examples, both historically and in the present moment, of how this country's arms sales have done more harm than good. But for now, let's just highlight four of them, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Nigeria, and the Philippines. Saudi Arabia has spearheaded a horrifying and disastrous 7.5-year-long intervention in Yemen that has killed thousands of people through indiscriminate airstrikes on civilian targets, ranging from hospitals, water treatment plants and factories to marketplaces, weddings and even a funeral. In all, that conflict has caused an estimated nearly 400,000 deaths, in large part due to a Saudi-run air and sea blockade that has impeded importing food, medical supplies and fuel. The overwhelming presence of U.S.-supplied aircraft, bombs, missiles, and other weaponry in that military campaign has led many Yemenis to view it as an American war on their country, sparing resentment and potentially damaging future relations throughout the region. In Yemen, it could help stop the killing tomorrow simply by cutting off arms, spare parts, and help in the maintenance of weapon systems. Such pressure would push the Saudi regime to definitively end its destructive airstrikes and its devastating blockade of that country, while potentially encouraging the launching of good faith negotiations to end the war in Yemen. When it comes to Egypt, the Biden administration has offered more than $6 billion in weaponry so far, including missiles, helicopters, and transport planes. All of that is going to the regime of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is widely regarded as the most repressive leader in that country's history. The al-Sisi government has gunned down demonstrators in the street, locked up thousands of political prisoners, and run a scorched-earth counterinsurgency campaign in the northern Sinai Desert that has killed innocent civilians and driven thousands of people from their homes. Last April, the U.S. regime offered attack helicopters worth millions to Nigeria, marking the latest stage in the warming of relations between the two countries that began early in the Trump years. That was $997 million. The Nigerian military, however, has committed torture on a massive scale while targeting thousands of civilians in an ongoing campaign against the terrorist group Boko Haram and its local offshoots. As Human Rights Watch has reported, there is a reasonable basis to believe that Nigerian security forces have committed crimes against humanity. Amnesty International reported that 10,000 civilians died between 2011 and 2020 from extreme neglect in prisons run by Nigeria's military. And far from reducing terrorism, such conduct has further destabilized significant parts of the country, stoking opposition to the government and making it easier for terrorist groups to recruit and operate. Earlier this month, the security situation in Nigeria had deteriorated so badly that Biden administration ordered the family members of U.S. diplomats to leave Abuja, the capital, due to a heightened risk of terrorist attack. The website of Truth Out noted, while the humanitarian consequences of U.S. arms sales may be devastating, if you happen to be a major weapons maker like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, or General Dynamics, the economic benefits are enormous. Weapon systems built by those four companies alone have figured in more than half of the $100 billion-plus in major arms
offers made since President Biden took office. While those firms prefer to pose as passive beneficiaries of carefully considered government policies, they continue to work overtime to loosen restrictions on weapons exports and expand the number of countries eligible for such equipment and training. To that end, those four giant firms alone routinely donate millions of dollars to key members of Congress while employing 300 lobbyists, many of them drawn from the ranks of the Pentagon, Congress, and the National Security Council. Once on board, those retired generals, admirals, and other officials use their government contacts and inside knowledge of the arms sales process to influence government policies and practices. Particularly egregious and visible example of this was Raytheon's effort to pressure Congress and the Trump administration to approve a sale of precision-guided munitions to the Saudis. A former Raytheon lobbyist, Charles Faulkner, worked inside the State Department to keep the Saudi arm pipeline open despite that country's bombing of civilian targets in Yemen, and then Raytheon's former CEO, Thomas Kennedy, even went so far as to directly lobby Senate Foreign Relations Chairman Senator Rob Menendez over Saudi arms sales. He was rebuffed. But the most spectacular lobbyist for the Saudi was, of course, Trump, who justified continuing arms sales to Riyadh after the regime's 2018 murder of U.S. resident, Saudi journalist, and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi this way. $110 billion will be spent on the purchase of military equipment from Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and many other great U.S. defense contractors. If we foolishly cancel these contracts, Russia and China would be enormous beneficiaries and very happy to acquire all this newfound business. It would be a wonderful gift to them directly from the United States, he said. In fact, neither Russia nor China would be able to replace the U.S. as Saudi Arabia's primary arms supplier anytime soon. The kingdom is so reliant on American equipment that it might take a decade or more for it to rebuild its military around weapons supplied by another nation. In reality, expensive as American arms sales to the Saudi are, that $110 billion figure was a typical case of Trumpian exaggeration. Actual sales during his term were less than one-third of that, and jobs tied to those sales in the U.S. were similarly far less than President Trump claimed. The figure he liked to throw around, 500,000, was at least 12 times the actual one. Still, the damage done by the weaponry his administration rammed through Congress for the Saudis has been incalculable and can't be measured by the dollar value of any particular sale. The Raytheon lobbying campaign was extraordinary primarily because its details became public knowledge, but count on one thing. Similar efforts by other military-industrial corporations surely take place behind closed doors on a regular basis. One precondition for reducing dangerous arms deals would have to be reducing the political power of the major weapons-producing companies. Also, responsible statecraft wrote U.S. military forces have been engaged in unauthorized hostilities in many more countries than the Pentagon has disclosed to Congress, let alone the public, according to a major new report released late last week by New York University School of Law's Brennan Center for Justice. Afghanistan, Iraq, maybe Libya. If you ask the average American where the United States has been at war in the past two decades, you would likely get this short list, according to the report. Secret war, how the U.S. uses partnerships and proxy forces to wage war under the radar. But This list is wrong, off by at least 17 countries in which the United States has engaged in armed conflict through ground forces, proxy forces, or airstrikes. The report's author Catherine Yan Ebright wrote in the introduction, "This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and very dangerous. The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations."
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort...
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher. An introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim, Shia dignitaries and ulama all across the world of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sayyid Mohsen and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding Shia mutakallim and faqih, that is Muhammad ibn Nu'man, mainly known as Shaykh Mufid or Shaykh al-Mufid, one of the most outstanding scholars of the Shia legacy and the author of the book Al-Irshad. Okay, Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you this time. Give us some details about the early life and biography of Shaykh al-Mufid.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The 4th and the 5th centuries of Islamic history are the centuries that a lot of great and outstanding scholars and narrators and transmitters of ahadith actually were born in those, centuries. One of the really important cause for this coming of these kind of scholars in those centuries is this, that because in those centuries there were lots of kind of debates, challenging kind of debates,
yes,
studies or conflict between the different Islamic sects. For example, in Ray, in Baghdad, in Balkh, in different areas, always there were lots of scholars from different sects. They were always challenging each other, discussing, debating.
Yes.
So from this kind of situation or environment, these great scholars actually came to the history of the Islam.
Yes.
So one of them is this Shaykh Mufid, rahmatullahi alayhi. Shaykh Mufid was not only a faqih, he was also a great theologian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is he called Mufid? Because once he had a very tough kind of debate and discussion with one of the Mu'tazilid scholar, Romani. Then finally, he convinced that Mu'tazili that your ideas, your opinions were wrong, mm-hmm, and false,
okay,
and ours are true. And he finally confessed, that Mu'tazili scholar. Then he gave this name to Shaykh al-Mufid,
mm-hmm,
said he is Shaykh al-Mufid.
Okay.
So, you know, he was a very strong and kind of powerful theologian at that time. We know that Mu'tazilids or Ash'arids or Shi'ids, those Mu'tazilids scholars or theologians and Ash'ari theologians, they have lots of kind of powerful and strong and fruitful ideas, lots of people at that time were following them. But when it comes to the Sheikh Mufid or the other Shia scholars, the theologians, alhamdulillah, they finally succeeded to express, to spread the true teachings of the school of Ahlul Bayt and to defeat the opponents of the, the Shia. And I think this is very much important that should be taken into consideration while talking about Sheikh Mufid and the other great scholars.
Okay, that's all right.
Some kind of personal characteristics of Sheikh Mufid is also very interesting
to
be mentioned.
Yes, yes.
It is said about him that he was giving a lot of sadaqah and charity, which is one of his characteristics. Yes. And the other one is this, that he was very much humble.
Yes.
And he said lots of, he was saying lots of prayers and dua and fasting all the days, every day.
Yes.
So this is very nice of him.
Okay.
And sometimes he were clothing himself by that kind of clothing that was, it seems that he was like Sufi, like tasawwuf. The tasawwuf also was very much the same as this kind of clothing they had.
That's right.
So that's why sometimes they call him as a teacher, as a let's say, master of the tasawwuf.
Okay.
Yeah. And
but in fact, he was not.
He was not.
Yes.
He was not. Just he was dressed in a way that the normal, the poor people, like poor people.
The pooper, that's
this was his, this, because of his humbleness.
Okay.
And of course, he slept very little, very few just hours in the night.
Yes.
But most of the time, he was studying and reciting the Holy Quran and saying the prayers and teaching. This
that's
was
right.
some of the main characteristics of Sheikh Mufid.
Let's get to his scholarly life, Sayyid Mohsen. What kind of maktab or maktab al-fikriya that did he belong to? And what was his main majors, I mean, field of study? Was it fiqh? Was it hadith? Was it kalam? What was it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, at the time of Sheikh Mufid, there were two main schools. One was for Mu'tazili, which was the, we can say, like the Sunni school of Sunni school. And the school that was at the, for the Mu'tazili, it was in Baghdad, which was known as the intellectuals of that time. Well, they used to believe that the Aql is everything. It's above the Quran and obviously the beliefs that the Mu'tazili had. On the other hand, we had the Ray, which was the Hadith or traditionals. And they used to just believe in the traditions.
Yes.
So both of them were extremes.
Mm-hmm.
Extremes. Like they extremely believed in the intellect. The other group was extremely believing in the traditions. On the other hand, Sheikh Mufid, because he was the student of Sheikh Saduq, from the students of that. And Sheikh Saduq has said that the Aql cannot reach to a point without the revelation. The Wahi should be next to it. Therefore, he went to both schools, and he was the first Shia scholar who gathered both things. Like he opted the middle way between the Aql and the tradition.
Yes.
So he wasn't extremely believing one side. That
a moderate look.
A moderate look he had.
That's right.
And this made him one of the famous personalities of his time.
Yes.
And when he used to argue with the people, obviously he used to listen to them and he used to answer them. On the other hand, obviously he was known as the mutakallim, which is the theologian. He was a faqih, a jurisprudent, and a Shia jurisprudence. And on the top of that, when he was basically combining the Aql, the intellect, and the traditions, there he came up, obviously, it is also said that he was the person who wrote the first book of Usul Fiqh.
Yes, Usul Fiqh.
Usul Fiqh, like the principles of the jurisprudence.
Yes.
So it was based on the, obviously, when we look at the book, like, which is the principles of jurisprudence, the whole discussion is like, how can we benefit from the fiqh and using the intellect as well?
That's
so
right.
This is about the Sheikh Mufid. And on the other hand, obviously, Sheikh Tusi also has talked about him. He said, like, he was one of the most intelligent personalities, the one who used to answer in very quickly to the answers, to the questions. And obviously, he was the one who advanced the theology and the jurisprudence in the Shia school of thought.
Yes.
He's from amongst those scholars who had advanced these two knowledges at that time, sciences.
Okay. That's all right. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, what about his most outstanding books?
I mean, for example, in fiqh or in kalam or in tariq, you know, he had outstanding works. What about them?
You know, the most important point about the works and ideas and thoughts and all the efforts that scholars like Sheikh Mufid made in the history is this, that we know that historically Tarking Tashayyu was not supported by the Salatin, by the Khulafa.
Yes.
Rather, all the Khulafa, the Amawid, the Abbasids, all these Khulafa and Salatin were opposed to Tashayyu.
Okay.
Even if sometimes, for example, Khalifa in Baghdad, when even sometimes they give, for example, some chances to the Shia scholars, the main objective and purpose of those Khulafa was this, to make fun of these scholars, the Shia scholars.
Yes.
Because the majority of these scholars in those gatherings and those kind of discussions and debates were the Sunni scholars, were the opponent of the Tashayyu.
Yes.
So when, for example, one single person as a Shia scholar come to that gathering and Khalifa also support all those Sunni scholars. So yes. What will happen? The result is clear.
Yes.
I think one of the very important and significance of the scholars like Sheikh Mufid is this, that in such a kind of environment, in such a kind of situation, they defended Tashayyu,
yes,
and they expressed the teachings, and even sometimes they defeated their opponents by their works, by their books, by their debates, by their discussions.
Especially debates.
Debates, yeah.
Because
participating in the debate,
yes, and not fearing, for example, course, the right position.
If you are not sure about yourself, you cannot attend those kind of debates in which lots of great Sunni scholars or opponents are there.
Yes.
And even the government and the caliph supporting them.
Yes, very good.
It's really dangerous, really horrifying for a scholar to attend that kind of meeting.
And we know that
he will be beheaded if something happened, because
during
the
history of Islam, so many of the Shia scholars lost their lives.
Of course, that's true.
Yes,
I think from this perspective, if you look at the life and the efforts and the services of Shaykh Mufid rahmatullah alayhi to the Islam, to the true teachings of Islam, to the school of Ahlul Bayt, we see that such a great role was played by these kind of scholars.
Yes.
And they should be really, really appreciated, and we should make lots of dua for these kind of scholars.
That's right.
Who actually saved the people from being misguided, being achieved by the other kind of, let's say, sects, other kind of groups. So that's why I think from this perspective, the works of Sheikh Mufid and the efforts he made is really, really admirable and appreciated, I think.
That's right. So Al-Mughna'ah, among the fiqh, Al-Irshad in history, you know, and the other books, what about them? Can you give us some details about, for example, Al-Mughna'ah, the fiqh book of Sheikh Al-Mufid, or Al-Irshad, which is the most famous book, I think, isn't it? Sheikh Mufid is mostly known with Al-Irshad.
Well, obviously, about the Al-Mughna, obviously, this is the book which was written on the jurisprudence, the hadith, the traditions that were about the prayer, about the, fasting, hajj, the inheritance. So
the practical laws of
practical
Islam.
The practical laws of Islam were there. And one of the famous book of Sheikh Tusi, which is Tahzibul Ahkam, it is also written on the basis of Al-Mughna.
Very good.
So even we can see like the importance of this book, that later Sheikh Tusi comes and he expands the Al-Mughna to Tahzibul Ahkam, and he gives the shar or the explanation of the book.
Yes.
So obviously these were the important books, and the main point was that it had the traditions. And you know, when we talk about the traditions, we very easily say like it is made of traditions, but the important point is that in traditions it should be authentic.
Yes.
At that time, you know, we should not look at the time in which we are living right now.
Yes.
You know, for example, now we have softwares.
Yes.
We have all these books, in a software. When I type in a word, so the word, all the ahadith, they come, the narrators, the list of narrators, I do have that.
Yes.
At that time, they used to travel.
Mm-hmm.
That was the hardest thing.
Yes.
You know, they had the handwritten books, different writing styles.
Yes.
You should know how to read that. And on top of that, you need to research whether this hadith, when they said like this person has narrated, is really been narrated by that or not. These kind of research at that time, like 1,000 years ago, when we look at this, the situation was different. There was no computer, nothing. They have to travel sometimes, you know, to different parts of the to the of the world. Yes. In order to get a book, and then later if they found like this is not an authentic thing, then obviously the traveling was in vain. But obviously they have done all these things.
Even in his story, it is mentioned that in a fiqh verdict, he did something wrong, but yes, it was corrected by Imam Asr.
Imam Al Asr,
yes, yes, yes.
It was about a person came to Sheikh Mufid and he asked, like, if a woman dies.
When pregnant.
Pregnant, while yes, she's pregnant, yes, and the baby is alive.
Yes.
So shall we bury the woman or
okay,
not? So he said to bury.
Okay.
And later, like, a guy on the way, he met that person who, yes, who got this ruling from Sheikh Mufid. And he said that you need to open the stomach and obviously take out the baby,
yes,
from the mother and then bury the mother.
Yes.
And this guy later came back to Sheikh Mufid and said, you send the guy after me like to tell me like mm-hmm, to open the
yes,
stomach, take out the baby. And there he realized that this is none other the Imam Al-Asr.
Imam Al-Asr, yes.
And then he stopped giving fatwa after yes, that because he made yes, a mistake.
Yes, yes.
And after that, it is said like Imam has come to him and he said to him that you need to give fatwa because even if you do wrong, we will make it right.
We will make it correct.
We'll correct
we correct
that.
You.
Yes.
Okay, this is really good, you know, how, for example, a faqih is corrected by Imam Asr. One important point about his scholarly life is writing comparative book, for example, a kalami book under the title Awailul Maqalat fil Mazahib al Mukhtarat, you know, which is a kalami book in Arabic language in a comparative way, for example, on a faqih issue or a kalami issue, you know, you give the opinions of the Shiite scholars and then, for example, the ideas of the Sunni scholars too. And this yeah, is, yeah, I think, the comparative studies was really founded by him on that.
The other book is Al-Irshad, which is a
yes,
famous
Al-Irshad
book.
Yes, one point that you rightly mentioned was this, that the comparative studies made
yes,
by
yes,
these scholars. It was really important at that time, you know, because at that time, actually, like Hanafis, Shafi'is, Ismailis, and Zaydis, and all these different sects
yes,
were powerful, and their scholars were there, and they were always publishing their ideas, their books, their works. And so so many people were the followers of them.
Yes.
So that's why when the Shia scholars wanted to publish their works or their ideas, so they had to deal with those opponent or the opposite ideas as well.
Yes.
Because the people always had access to those kind of sources, to those yes, kind of works. So that's why it was the duty of the scholars at that time to deal sometimes with those ideas as well. And also to try to convince the people that those kind of ideas are not true according to the Islamic principles, according to the Islamic sources, according to the Quran or the true teachings of Islam. So this way, actually, they preserve the true Islam and the true ideas of Islam. I think this kind of comparative works of the scholars like Sheikh Mufid is really,
yes,
really the most valuable kind of works in the history because by this way, when a Shia, for example, studied these kind of books, he understood, okay, that's the idea of Zaydi, that's the idea of Ash'arids, let's say Mu'tazilites
yes,
or these different sects.
Yes, yes.
And this is the idea of the Shayyu.
Okay, okay.
He would understand a better kind of understanding of the true teachings of the Shayyu.
Okay. So what about Al-Irshad, Sayyid Mohsen? Al-Irshad fi ma'rifati hujjajillah ala al-ibad.
Well, actually, the name is like what you said, Al-Irshad fi ma'rifati hujjajillah ala ibadi.
Yes.
Which means like Irshad is the book which is in knowing the hujjajillah, the authorities of Allah upon the mankind.
Who are they?
Ahlul Bayt.
Oh, Ahlul Bayt. So this is the historical book
yeah,
about
historical
Ahlul
book.
Yes, very good.
It's it shows like this book was written on the life of the Ahlul Bayt basically,
uh-huh,
and the life of the 12 infallible Imams from Imam Ali alayhi salam till Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Good.
And there obviously he brought the fadail of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the story of the Karbala, how what happened, and
oh,
the life of the companions, some of the companions of them.
Oh.
So this was basically a book which gives the knowledge to the people
mm-hmm,
about the Ahlul Bayt, what kind of belief we need to have about them. When they're known as the authority of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala
oh,
over the servants of Allah.
Good.
So Allah then sent them as an authority, then we need to basically obey them.
Oh.
And this was the main idea of Al-Irshad,
yes,
which he wrote. And
it has 12 babs or, for example, chapters, each of them named after an infallible imam, starting with Imam Ali alayhi salam and done with Imam Asr, okay? So,
yes,
really beautiful, you know, historically. And what is important about this book is that he brought the documents and the references for that, make it so much, we can say, authentic about the life accounts of the infallible imams. That's all right. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen. About his demise, 413, this outstanding man passed away, and his body was taken into the city of Al-Kadhimiyyah. He is buried in vicinity of the tomb of Imam Musa al-Kazim, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Thank you very much, Muhammad ibn Nu'man, mainly known as Sheikh al-Mufid, the author of Awail al-Maghalat, al-Irshad, al-Mughna, and so many other outstanding books. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. Thank you much, Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi and Sheikh Rouhani. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amal Allah.